Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
On manque d'ouvriers spécialisés dans le monde entier. Le métavers peut contribuer à résoudre ce problème. La plateforme de formation en réalité virtuelle de ForgeFX permet aux futurs soudeurs de s'entraîner encore et encore. Ils apprennent ainsi les compétences nécessaires pour débuter et faire évoluer leur carrière. Meta et le métavers ont déjà un impact.
People Fixing the World is the podcast looking for solutions to the problems we face today.
It could potentially ease the suffering of millions.
We have a solution. Let's do it.
People Fixing the World from the BBC World Service.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Andrew Peach, and in the early hours of Saturday, the 6th of April, these are our main stories. Aid organisations want an independent investigation into the deadly drone strike on an aid convoy after the Israeli Defence Forces published their first account of what happened. Thousands of people in the city of Orsk in the Russian Urals are evacuated after a breach of their river embankment. Facebook and Meta say they'll label AI-generated content on their sites. Also in this podcast, the dog from California who turned up in Michigan.
She jumped out of the car seat into the window and just basically into our arms, and she knew exactly who we were, and it was wonderful.
First, the aid organisation World Central Kitchen has dismissed an Israeli report into the killing of its workers in Gaza on Monday as cold comfort and demanded an independent investigation. Its call's been repeated by the families of those killed in the Israeli drone strike on an aid convoy. Israel says it's dismissed two senior officers involved and punished others after finding serious errors. The Israel Defense Forces investigation found there'd been a series of errors leading up to the airstrike on three vehicles operated by the charity. The report said an aid worker had been mistaken for a Hamas gunman. It also said after an initial strike, two more were launched at other vehicles for what it called no real reason. Our correspondent Lucy Williamson reports from Jerusalem.
The errors and assumptions build layer on layer in the army's narrative of Monday night. The coordinated route that wasn't communicated to troops, the charity logo that wasn't visible at night, the untested assumptions that caused what the IDF calls a grave mistake. The airstrikes that pounded the World Central Kitchen convoy as it returned from an aid warehouse were called in after forces mistook a bag one passenger was carrying for a gun. Peter Lerner, an IDF spokesman, said the mistake happened shortly after gunmen had been spotted arriving and leaving the warehouse in other vehicles.
It was a visual confirmation of a gunman, first of all, on one of the trucks that then conducted shooting from one of the trucks. And when they indeed reached the hangars, there were more gunmen identified on the location. And it led basically to the entire miscalculation, misidentification, and the failure of what should have happened.
The army has fired two senior officers who approved the strikes, but World Central Kitchen has called for an independent inquiry, saying the IDF cannot credibly investigate its own failure and that systemic change was needed. The Secretary General of Médecins Sans Frontières, Christopher Lockyer, rejected claims that this was a tragic mistake.
This is not just an incident. This is a series, a pattern of incidents that have been going on for months and months now. We're now up to the stage of having 200 humanitarian workers killed. We are operating in an environment of complete impunity. It is a deliberate choice to allow these attacks to continue to happen.
One former Major General, Giora Eiland, says Israeli forces have also killed their own compatriots by mistake.
This is a huge mistake. Unfortunately, many, many other mistakes were made. For instance, Israel killed three Israeli hostages that managed to release themselves, and nevertheless, they were killed by Israeli soldiers, and of course, no one believed that we killed them deliberately.
Israel says its war is with Hamas, not Gaza's civilians, that it's fighting one and feeding the other. But aid workers accuse Israel of seeing them as targets and aid as a weapon of war.
Under pressure from the US President Joe Biden, Israel has promised to open up three crossings into Gaza to let more aid in. The UN Secretary General has welcomed the move, but said it had to be quick. The US Secretary of State Antony Blinken said Washington would be monitoring how many trucks carrying aid were getting into Gaza. Here's our diplomatic correspondent, Paul Adams.
After months of cajoling, the disastrous events of Monday night and a tense phone call between Joe Biden and Benjamin Netanyahu, Israel seems poised to take steps which could significantly improve the supply of humanitarian assistance. For the first time since November, the container port at Ashdod will once again be open for shipments of aid, albeit on a temporary basis. This should allow for much larger quantities to be imported, reducing the need for airdrops and the makeshift pier recently constructed near Gaza City. Israel also says it'll open the major crossing point at Erez, attacked and ransacked by Hamas gunmen on October the 7th. Erez is designed for passengers, not freight, but it offers direct access into northern Gaza. The US Secretary of State Antony Blinken welcomed the news.
These are positive developments, but the real test is results. And that's what we're looking to see in the coming days and in the coming weeks. And some of the measures that we're looking to include things like the number of trucks that are actually getting in on a sustained basis and get not just getting in, but then getting around.
Aid agencies say anything that gets more aid in is welcome. But after almost 6 months of war, an elaborate system of humanitarian assistance throughout the Gaza Strip is on its knees, especially in the north, where conditions are increasingly dire. Scott Paul of Oxfam America said it's not just about food.
The kind of humanitarian assistance that's needed to manage and mitigate and bring people back from a famine in northern Gaza is not flooding the zone with food. It's flooding the zone with people and medicine and medical supplies. And that requires a kind of operating environment that we are nowhere close to having right now.
Opening the gates to Gaza is one thing. That crucial operating environment, whose fragility was so cruelly exposed on Monday night, is another.
There are growing signs that Monday's attack on the World Central Kitchen convoy may prove to be a pivotal moment in Israel's war with Hamas. This assessment from our international editor, Jeremy Bowen.
For the first time in this war, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu seems to have listened to Joe Biden. He put enough pressure on Mr. Netanyahu during their conference call last night to extract unusually rapid concessions from the Israelis. Perhaps he threatened to attach conditions to the use of American weapons in Gaza. The killing of the team from the World Central Kitchen seems to have been a tipping point for President Biden. It is too soon to say whether this is a turning point in the war. Israel's critics say the attack on the aid workers was not an isolated incident, but the result of an ingrained disregard for the lives of Palestinian civilians. Any change in Israel's conduct can be measured by the numbers of Palestinian civilians killed by its military or by the famine created by Israel's siege. Another test will be whether Mr. Netanyahu goes ahead with a ground assault on Rafah, despite America's opposition.
Now to other news. Officials in the Russian Urals say thousands of people are being evacuated after a section of an embankment dam burst in a major city. Here's Sasha Schlichter.
Video posted online shows an angry torrent of water gushing through a breach in a low-slung earthen dam on the shore of the Ural River in Orsk. The city's streets are flooded. People are moving around in boats and dinghies. It's late at night there, but heavy earth-moving machinery is on site trying to shore up the dam. Earlier, an emergency was declared across the entire Orenburg region after river levels rose dangerously due to melting ice. Officials say 10,000 residents may be in the flooding zone. The evacuees are being moved to nearby schools.
Ukraine has carried out a series of drone attacks on targets in southern Russia. Security sources said at least six Russian military planes were destroyed on Thursday, and another eight were badly damaged in several military sites around the Rostov region. Kyiv's drone attacks have become an increasingly important part of its defences against Moscow forces, as Nikki Cardwell explains.
The Ukrainian army has been quite open about its development and use of drones, but the programme has only recently begun to pay off. 3 days ago, two drones hit targets more than 1,000 kilometres inside Russia. It was the furthest that Ukraine has ever been able to attack inside Russian territory. Ukraine is now claiming to have destroyed 6 Russian military planes bombed on the ground at their bases. The smallest drones used by the Ukrainian army are video-piloted, known as FPV drones. Small and quick, they don't have a huge range and are used in kamikaze missions where they dive-bomb targets and self-destruct or to drop explosives. Many of these are built by volunteers like Bill Smith, an engineer from the United States who runs a 3D printer factory in Ukraine.
Someone in the military is looking to make drones. They send the digital file to this intermediate website, and there's something like 1,800 printers all over Ukraine with these, like a printer on their kitchen table. And so they'll go on the army site, and they'll say, okay, I'll do 10 of these or 100 of those, and they'll take the file and put it into their printers, print it, and then send it back to the army.
Sea baby drones are the aquatic vehicles which are being used to attack Russia's Black Sea fleet. At the beginning of March, a sea baby reportedly sank a Russian warship. The first wave of these drones was crowdfunded. This woman, who wishes to remain anonymous, has donated thousands to the programme.
I was fortunate enough to actually be invited to go to Ukraine. I spent around about 12 hours speaking to the soldiers that were headed to the front line. So there was a really clear understanding around how important it was for the drone technology, because that means that the soldiers can be a little bit further back. They can use that drone rather than sending in people.
In recent months, Ukraine has stepped up its drone attacks on Russian territory, targeting both military sites and energy facilities in an attempt to knock out the fuel and equipment supplies used by Russia for the invasion. With its troops on the ground on the defensive, Kyiv will be hoping that its drone army can help swing things back in their favour.
On Friday, the southern Ukrainian city of Zaporizhia came under a massive deadly Russian rocket attack. 3 people were killed, 13 wounded, 4 of them seriously. Zimbabwe, where people largely use US dollars for transactions, is pinning its hopes on a new currency, the Zimbabwe Gold, or ZiG. It'll be backed by the country's gold reserves, and people now have a couple of weeks to hand in their old banknotes. Previous attempts to stabilise the local currency, though, haven't been a success. Here's our correspondent, Shingai Nyoka.
It's a currency that comes with a new name, as well as new notes and coins denominated in value from about a quarter of a ZiG, and that's the new name, the Zimbabwe Gold, to about $200. And it also comes with a new exchange rate starting at 13.5 ZiG to one US dollar. So essentially what the central bank has done, it's removed lots of zeros from the Zimbabwe dollar, which they have laid to rest. And so the currency value has been slashed. It's a currency that will float according to the market-related exchange rate, according to the central bank. It'll be backed by precious minerals, mainly gold, as well as foreign currency reserves. And so it's being introduced with immediate effect, but Zimbabweans have about 3 weeks to surrender the old currency, and banks and businesses have about 7 days to begin using this currency.
Okay, and why is Zimbabwe repeatedly in this situation of extraordinary inflation and therefore the need to do something to right the currency?
Well, essentially, I think it's because there's this tug of war between what the government wants and what the people want. You might remember in 2007, about 17 to 20 years ago, there was a local currency that was hit by inflation. And so people just off their own accord started using the US dollar. And what happened is that the government was then forced to abandon that Zimbabwe dollar, which at some point, I think the inflation was over 1,000,000,000%.
In other words, it's never worked before. You end up with the big inflation on the Zimbabwean currency and then the flight to the US dollar for any important transactions. Why is it more likely to work now?
Well, that's not clear. And there's a lot of skepticism on the street. And just as an illustration of that, when we heard the news that there was going to be this new currency or this new statement, there was an incredible run on the banks. So there were long, long lines of people waiting to withdraw whatever money that they could because they weren't sure what the government was going to do. And so now that they've announced that this new currency will be different, that it'll be backed by gold and it'll also be backed by foreign exchange, which is something that they really haven't done before. We haven't really had a gold-backed currency. So they're hoping that that will increase confidence. And there's been an admission by the central bank that it's only when there's confidence that you can have a stable currency. But we've heard all of this before. This is the fifth time in the last 17 or so years that Zimbabwe has introduced a new currency. And all of those times it's crashed because people simply don't want to hold on to it. They prefer to have the comfort of a stable US dollar.
Our correspondent, Shinga Nyoko, with me. From next month, Facebook and Instagram will apply made with AI labels to artificially generated videos, images and audio. The change comes ahead of the US election in November, which is poised to test Meta's ability to police deceptive content generated by AI technology on its platforms. Here's Chris Vallance.
Meta's new rules mean that artificial intelligence-generated or altered content in posts will stay up in the interests of free speech, but will be clearly labelled as made with AI. Only if the content breaks its existing policies, such as on hate speech or voter interference, will it be removed. Meta admitted that its previous rules were too narrow, as they only covered videos and only content which made someone appear to say something they didn't. The new policy was welcomed by the Oversight Board, which called for the changes.
Staying with artificial intelligence, voice cloning is becoming easier, faster and more convincing. It's possible, using AI, to change the age of an actor's voice, translate into any language or replace a voice lost through illness. But it's also increasingly being used by criminals to impersonate a loved one, extort money or compromise bank accounts. It's changing how we communicate, as Nicola Stanbridge reports.
ReSpeecher is a Ukrainian AI company at the forefront of cloning speech that's indistinguishable from a human voice. Much of its work carried on in bomb shelters during the Russian invasion. They've worked on Disney's Obi-Wan Kenobi, cloning James Earl Jones's voice for Darth Vader. Alex Serdiuk is ReSpeecher's CEO and founder. How close to real-time conversations are we?
We are there, I would say. We have a piece of technology that allows change in real time, meaning a very small delay, several hundred milliseconds, that would make it quite smooth for a phone conversation. So we can change our voice on the fly at the moment. We applied our real-time models, wonderful technology for healthcare. Good example would be laryngectomy patients. Those are mostly people who went through throat cancer and their vocal box been removed. The challenge we have is to make the technology controllable and make sure that bad players are not ruining the market. Some irresponsible companies reveal the technology, letting anyone create anyone's voice within seconds with the quality that would trick people.
Last year, Jennifer DiStefano told the US Senate Judiciary Committee about a frightening anonymous phone call she thought was a call for help from her daughter.
"Mom, these bad men have me. Help me, help me, help me," she begged and pleaded as the phone was taken from her. A threatening and vulgar man took the call over. "Listen here, I have your daughter. You call anybody, you call the police. I'm going to pop her stomach so full of drugs, I'm going to have my way with her. I'm going to drop her in Mexico and you'll never see your daughter again."
A friend called 911, which warned Jennifer there was a scam involving voice cloning.
"But I didn't process that. It wasn't just her voice. It was her cries. It was her sobs."
Professor Brent Mittelstad from the Oxford Internet Institute specializes in AI ethics, law and policy.
There are a number of proposals in the U.S. to basically fight robocalls or scam calls or fraud calls. America is further ahead. The AI Act is a new regulatory framework that has recently been passed in the European Union. There is political will, whereas in the UK, there is hesitancy at this stage in AI's development.
The UK's National Reporting Centre for Fraud and Cybercrime, Action Fraud, says sophisticated voice cloning technology is increasingly prevalent, but victims might be unaware they're being targeted.
When we know that AI has very clear risks and harms and benefits, to be fair, right now, to not regulate such transformative technology seems like a huge missed opportunity. And I think that's why we see the EU and the US acting now to actually regulate it.
Nicola Stanbridge reporting. And still to come.
The Austrian Alpine Club, which has been measuring glaciers for 133 years, said 2023 was exceptionally unfavourable for glaciers.
A mountaineering organisation warns that Austria risks becoming largely ice-free within 45 years.
People fixing the world.
Brilliant solutions to the world's problems.
All right, let's do this.
We meet people with ideas to make the world a better place.
Trying new things that they're really passionate about.
And investigate whether they work.
The idea is you send in a robot where it's unsafe to send another human being.
Wow, okay.
People Fixing the World from the BBC World Service.
Buckle up and get ready to ride.
Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. President Biden has said he won't rest until Baltimore's Key Bridge is rebuilt as he visited the scene where a cargo ship crashed into it, causing it to collapse into the harbour. His visit comes amid growing tensions in Congress over using federal funds to rebuild the bridge, which regional authorities say is necessary for the economy.
So far, our team has been able to clear two small channels for essential ships, helping clear the wreckage. And by the end of May, we'll open the full channel.
I heard more from our correspondent, Will Vernon, who's in Baltimore in Maryland.
President Biden came here today to send a message of support, I think, and reassurance to the local community. 10 days after that catastrophic bridge collapse, the president inspected the scene from the air. He met the families of those six construction workers that were tragically killed in the disaster. And in his speech, Mr. Biden told Baltimore that the nation has your back. He once again pledged to fully rebuild this bridge with federal funds, and he promised more help for workers, for local businesses here, because, of course, there is a big impact on the local economy. It's just not far from where I'm standing now, Baltimore Port, one of America's busiest. It's still closed. There's no traffic going in or out of that port, and that's because the river here is full of wreckage, concrete, metal, debris from that collapsed bridge.
There was a lot of worry about the impact that this incident would have on one of the busiest shipping lanes in the US. How is that playing out?
Well, I mean, you're right. This has a huge economic impact. The port directly generates over 15,000 jobs, say the authorities, with an additional 140,000 jobs indirectly dependent on the port's activity. So everything rests on when they can get that channel clear, get that port open. It's an incredibly complex operation. There's a huge amount of debris in that water. The water is incredibly deep, fast moving, icy water. The authorities were saying earlier that the visibility there is very low, less than a meter. So it's incredibly difficult for the divers that are working there underwater trying to cut up the metal to get the channel clear.
And is there any controversy about the rebuilding, the reconstruction, and how that's done?
There is. I mean, arguments are already breaking out over who exactly will foot the bill for this. As I said, President Biden has pledged federal government funds to cover the cost. But that, of course, needs to be approved by Congress. And Mr. Biden again today called on Congress to approve that funding. Many Republicans are skeptical about using federal dollars for such things. The House of Representatives here is very divided at the moment on just about everything, actually. But specifically when it comes to this kind of thing, hardliner Republicans, they're becoming increasingly dominant here. And they are particularly not keen on big spending bills like this.
Well, Vernon with me from Baltimore. Staying in the US, New York has experienced its biggest earthquake in 40 years. The magnitude 4.8 quake was felt across the state and beyond, but there are no reports of injury or damage to buildings. Our North America correspondent John Sudworth is in Manhattan.
The epicenter was in a rural area of the state of New Jersey, but the quake was big enough that some 50 miles to the east, within seconds, the residents of New York were lighting up social media with their accounts of buildings swaying and household items rattling. At the United Nations in Midtown Manhattan, where the Save the Children organization was addressing the Security Council, the session was abruptly halted, the moment caught on visibly wobbling video cameras.
education is...
That's great.
Is that wonderful?
Yeah.
Well, education is...
You're making the ground shake.
Education is, in many ways... Madam President, am I okay to continue?
The flurry of media excitement, however, has been prompted by the fact that earthquakes are relatively rare in this part of America, not because there have been any reports of any damage or injuries. And while there are warnings that aftershocks are possible, New York State Governor Kathy Hochul said there was no need for panic.
We are masters of disasters. We know how to handle this. We're always ready. We have planning in place. For all of our teams activate instantaneously.
While earthquakes are infrequent in New York, they are sometimes felt, the most recent one in January this year. Many others, though, are so tiny that they almost always go unnoticed.
Now, Spain has a reputation for its nightlife. People work late and eat late, with bars and restaurants open well after midnight. Could all that be about to change, though? The country's Deputy Prime Minister, Yolanda Díaz, who runs the left-wing platform Sumar, a partner of the coalition government, wants to bring Spain in line with the rest of Europe. She says working late hours is detrimental to the long-term health of staff. How realistic could that change be? Ashish Sharma took to the bars and restaurants of Madrid to find out.
Now, if I was to say to you that I work in a sector that contributes over $20 billion per year towards my country's GDP, you may well reply, great, leave it alone then. Don't change anything.
No es razonable un país que tiene abiertos sus restaurantes a la una de la madrugada.
Well, that's Yolanda Díaz, the Labour Minister and the Deputy Prime Minister, and she's talking about the food and drinks industry. Díaz wants bars and restaurants, which can stay open as late as 3 a.m., to close much earlier. But what do Spanish people who live this lifestyle, but also tourists, whose income represents about 12% of Spanish economy, think about the idea?
I think it's a really good idea. I agree, of course. I think she means that if you work until 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, you have to be well paid. It's not that now that we work until 1 o'clock, but the salary is not really proper for that schedule.
I don't want to change anything. I like Spain, I love Spain, and I would like to be... I like things like that.
When we're on the road, we like to get our days started early, and it's a difficult city to get things started early because things close so late, they tend to open late, which means that you don't have the opportunity to go tour and do things early in the morning when... You know, is an opportunity when it's less crowded and more, you know, advantageous to old people like myself.
Sin problema, sin problema.
No.
I've just wandered into the Mercado San Fernando, which is a really popular place, and I'm joined by the owner of one small bar called El Perenquen. I hope I've said it right, Borja. Borja, what do you think about the idea of bars and restaurants and cafes and clubs closing early?
That information is not good for us because we need to win money. If they close at 12 o'clock, maybe many locals will be closed. It's not possible to us, the workers. It's not a good decision for them too. It's not only for the enterprise. It's for the workers too.
So what would be your message then to Yolanda Díaz?
I don't want to close at 11 or 12. I need to open to 3 o'clock or 4 o'clock. The night is so important in Madrid. Many people only go out at the night. It's not possible.
Sociedades desarrolladas están funcionando 24 horas.
Vicente Biscueta is from the organization called Spain by Night, which represents bars, clubs, restaurants and discos.
All the world's major cities are active 24 hours a day. It goes without saying, such as the police, emergency services and so too workers in clubs. But there are also many other sectors such as cleaning and maintenance services. These can only function at night because their work can only start once the commercial activities of the day have finished, and that's when they take over.
It's coming up to lunchtime, and the bars and restaurants here in Madrid are beginning to fill up. Yolanda Díaz wants her country's working patterns to be more in line with the rest of Europe. That's to say, a 35-hour working week. But by starting with the country's nightlife and social habits, she may well have jumped off in the deep end.
Ashish Sharma in Madrid. Next to Austria, a mountaineering organisation is warning that the country risks becoming largely ice-free within 45 years, with almost all of its glaciers disappearing. In its annual report, the Austrian Alpine Club said 92 out of 93 glaciers it measured over the past year had shrunk due to climate change. Here's our correspondent Bethany Bell.
The Austrian Alpine Club, which has been measuring glaciers for 133 years, said 2023 was exceptionally unfavourable for glaciers. On average, they shrank by 23 metres. The report says heat waves and dry conditions over the past couple of years mean glaciers have been unable to regenerate. Gerhard Lieb from the Alpine Club called on Austria's leaders to take action to protect the glaciers and their surroundings as a matter of urgency.
The disappearance of the glaciers is a sign of how climate change is increasingly a problem for society. And now is the time for politicians to respond more decisively.
The most badly affected glacier was the Pasterze in the southern province of Carinthia, which shrank by more than 203 metres, a new record. The Rettenbachferne glacier in Tyrol shrank by 127 metres. The Alpine Club warned against expanding ski resorts into glacier regions. It said Austria's winter tourism industry needed to adopt policies which were more environmentally friendly and sustainable.
A family from California have been reunited with their missing dog after she was found in a different US state more than 3,000 kilometres away from home. Almost 9 months after her disappearance, Mishka reappeared safe and well-fed, roaming around a suburb of Detroit. Our New York correspondent Neda Torfik takes up the tale.
Mishka's family has nicknamed her the Miracle Dog. Their heartwarming reunion was the happy ending to a cross-country tale that began when their golden-haired terrier mix disappeared last July from San Diego, California, only to be discovered more than 2,000 miles away in Michigan. How she ended up there is a mystery. After her disappearance, her owners, Murad and Liz Heumann, and their young daughter posted flyers around town and pleas on social media and had gone months without any encouraging news. Then, just as they were planning to visit relatives in Minneapolis for Easter weekend, they got a call from an animal shelter across the country that Mishka had been found.
I want to go see her.
I know Daddy's bringing her home.
Once the family landed in Minnesota, Murad drove 10 hours overnight to Michigan to get her. Liz says it felt like she never left.
She jumped out of the car seat into the window and just basically into our arms, and she knew exactly who we were, and it was wonderful.
It's all thanks to a Good Samaritan who reported a stray dog in their suburban Detroit neighborhood. Because Mishka had been chipped, executive director Corrine Hartman says the Grosse Pointe Animal Adoption Society was able to match her with her owners.
It's what everyone in an animal shelter hopes for. I mean, that's our job. The hope and the dream is always that you'll reunite them with their owner. And we would love to know the story, but only Mishka can tell us, and she's not talking.
Mishka's healthy and doing great, and the humans even discovered that she's learned a few new tricks, like how to sit in her time away from them.
Neda Torfik reporting. And that's all from us for now. There'll be a new edition of Global News to download later. If you'd like to comment on this edition and the stories we included, drop us an email. We love hearing from you. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk or on X, we are @GlobalNewsPod. This edition was mixed by Chris Murphy. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Andrew Peach. Thanks for listening. And until next time, goodbye.
People fixing the world.
People fixing the world. Brilliant solutions to the world's problems.
All right, let's do this.
We meet people with ideas to make the world a better place.
Trying new things that they're really passionate about.
And investigate whether they work.
The idea is you send in a robot where it's unsafe to send another human being.
Wow, okay.
People fixing the world from the BBC World Service.
Buckle up and get ready to ride.
Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.